Welcome back to Too Much Future, the show where we play the Fallout games and we talk about them. I'm Cameron.
I'm Michael.
Michael, we've played Fallout 1.
Mm-hmm.
We've played Fallout 2.
We have.
I'm having a hard time. I'm trying to do it on my fingers here. So there's one, and then there's two.
And then there's somehow two games called Brotherhood of Steel.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Okay.
Which are not numbers I'm familiar with. And the fact that there are two of them makes it additionally confusing.
There's Brotherhood of Steel, and then there's Tactics.
Well, it's called like Fallout Brotherhood of Steel Tactics or something.
Oh,
it's really weird.
Even better. So there's those games, and we're going to pretend like they don't exist because canonically, Fallout pretends like they don't exist. But we might go back. You never know. We might go back and do a little impressions episode. Although I don't think we were ever going to do a full season on either of those things. And doing it on my fingers here, getting to the fifth finger, Fallout 3.
Yes.
Which is what we're talking about today. This is a big move in the Fallout-iverse. Interplay, and then Black Isle, right, does Fallout 1 and 2. And then they have some, troubles.
Difficulties.
And in 2007, they sell, after several issues, several problems, one of which, if you listen to the other show that Range Touch has put out about CRPGs in the past, Mages and Murder Dads had a hard time coming up with it.
Yeah, I was wondering. I was wondering, is there like another one that I don't know about?
No, it's Mages and Murder Dads. And, there was Baldur's Gate 1 and then Baldur's Gate 2, and they were going to make a Baldur's Gate 3. And that didn't really happen for a long time. Now, weirdly enough, we're getting Baldur's Gate 3 very soon. But Baldur's Gate 3 didn't happen. And at the same time, around the same time period, they were going to make a Fallout 3, codenamed Van Buren, from the same team that had made Fallout 2. And for various publisher difficulty reasons, development hell problems, money, .. There's a lot of information you can read about this. Interplay ultimately ends up selling the Fallout license to Bethesda Softworks, who was famous for the Elder Scrolls games. And that happened in 2007.
Yep, but at that time, I think Bethesda had been working on their Fallout 3 for a couple of years, because I think prior to that, what had happened is they had licensed Fallout, and then they got they licensed Fallout at first, and then eventually when the troubles that Interplay was experiencing increased, they just ended up buying it outright.
Yeah, this Gama Sutra article from 2007. Gama Sutra is a video game kind of business website. I'm sure that you might have seen articles from them. If not, their archive is very good for finding out this kind of information, because it's just straight up business stuff. But yeah, prior to the purchase, this is a quote from an article by Brandon Boyer. Prior to the purchase, Bethesda was licensing the Fallout IP from Interplay as it has continued to develop Fallout 3, its own sequel to the cult classic post-apocalyptic RPG series, first developed by Black Isle Studios in 1997. In a recent interview, Bethesda's Pete Hines told Gama Sutra that the team was, quote, a fairly good ways into the process, and noted that, quote, Fallout is not a quick two-year process, and we are already several years into the project. And that's a little bit of a dig, I think, between Fallout and Fallout 2, the short development time there. But here's continuing the article. In an interesting twist, as part of the agreement, Interplay now acts as a licensee of the IP as it continues to ramp up production on its own Fallout 3 massively multiplayer game. First announced in 2004 alongside Bethesda's sequel and shown via internal documents as recently as December, to have a projected $75 million budget and a launch date of 2010. So Interplay sold Fallout to Bethesda, who were making their own Fallout game, and then they immediately licensed it back to make an MMO, kind of a World of Warcraft competitor, that ultimately never saw the light of day. And I guess, we see the long, long tail of that as Fallout 76, an online version of Fallout. So they did that. And then in 2008, Fallout 3 comes out, and it is a lot closer to a Bethesda game.
Yes. Well, because it is a Bethesda game.
Oh, that's true. But they could have made, for example, they could have made a top-down RPG, right?
They could have.
But they didn't. You know, they end up making something in the lineage of Morrowind or Oblivion.
Mm-hmm.
People had feelings about that.
They sure did.
Mm-hmm. I pulled up an article here. Just some additional info. It's by Luke Winky at Kotaku from 2015. It's called The Relentless Champions of Classic Fallout.
Uh-huh.
And I think that this is a great example, and no, I'm not in any way throwing Luke Winky under the bus here, but ultimately this is an article that is interviewing some people from the No Mutants Allowed website, which is kind of a classic Fallout fan site and mm-hmm. has been for a number of years. And ultimately it's a piece that ends up aligning with their perspective, which is that Fallout 1 and 2 had something special in them, and that gets distributed in a lot of different ways in the article, but they had something special that, for whatever reason, Fallout 3 just doesn't get. But I think, as I've said a few times on the show, that this is a great example of Fallout ideology, and that what is special about these two games is very ambiguous here in the thing, and it basically just goes down to, I like these other things, and I don't like this thing.
Mm-hmm.
Some of those things we're going to talk about in this episode, because I think that you can see them already, but it's different. It's a different kind of game. It's a different approach to an RPG, and it is aimed at a wider audience.
Mm-hmm.
In that it's a little bit more friendly, mm-hmm. and you can't aggro a whole town.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think actually one thing I wanted to mention that occurred to me between recording the last episode and this one is a big intervening term, I think, in how Fallout was imagined and how video games were imagined was BioShock.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that BioShock itself, and I remember because I was, to cast us back into the Abyss of Time, like I was, yeah. I was really excited for BioShock because I've said this on not necessarily this podcast, but one of our other ones, right? System Shock 2 was a huge game for me, like hugely important in how I interface with the medium and so on and so forth. So I was very into BioShock. I was following the hype very, very closely. And I remember BioShock in a lot of those developer interviews and so on and so forth, Fallout being hailed for certain aspects of that world. And of course, BioShock is we could have an entire other podcast about BioShock and how it succeeds and fails at whatever it's trying to do. But it is upfront about its social themes in a way that, you know, a AAA game at that time was not. And it also had a lot of clear Fallout DNA, sort of the retro future aesthetic, the really goofy like plasmid tutorial videos that were very much like Vault Tech, Vault Boy influenced. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, I was like playing this first bit of Fallout 3 and realizing that Fallout 3 is kind of a response to BioShock in the way that it does its kind of, you know, mise-en-scene, immersive simi kind of work. And in that way kind of actualizes a lot of stuff that was implicit or like sort of fan theories in Fallout 1 and 2, right? So it's very, very interesting in that respect.
Yeah, there's something in the water in this like 2006, 2007, 2008 time period. And a lot of people have talked about how the kind of explosion of games in 2007, 2008, you know, it really, the world of games changed in a particular kind of way. I mean, you get Mass Effect, Assassin's Creed, Fallout 3, BioShock. There's another couple.
Team Fortress 2, Portal, the Half-Life episodes start coming out. A lot of stuff.
There's another big, I mean, so on one hand, right, you can see that we're still living in the wake of those years, right? Like, we're still playing those. Oh, Uncharted 1 is somewhere right there, too,
yes.
I think.
Mm-hmm.
That's the one I was starting to think of. But that time period of the Xbox 360, PS3, and even PC gaming at that moment, there's something in the water that really kind of sets a different aesthetic standard and a different standard for writing. And maybe that just has to do with political economy, right? Maybe there's just enough money moving in. Kind of famously, the video game industry was one of the very few industries in the United States that wasn't annihilated by the financial collapse of 2007. And so, or 2007, 2008. And so that could be part of it too, right? That this is an industry where a lot of capital was flowing into it at the beginning of this new, of this console generation that ultimately ended up extending for a very long time. But a lot of money is flowing into it. And then in these development cycles, this economy or this industry didn't, the bottom didn't fall out in the way that it did for so many others. And so, you know, it ultimately ended up making a whole lot of money because there wasn't such a massive loss that happened there. So that's all to say, you know, whether it's increased development time, whether it's increased kind of reflexivity in the industry and thought about what they were making, whether it is just a confluence of historical events, whatever, I think you're right that there's something in the water of the time period that is sharpening maybe some of the ideas that we see in the other Fallout games. Or maybe, right, and I think this is a way of thinking about it too, maybe there's just stronger reflection on what to include and not include. It seems like, you know, playing Fallout 1, Fallout 2, and reading the Bible too, I think that's really important. Just whatever kind of worked, you know, there was kind of a gut feeling of like whatever works, works, and whatever doesn't, doesn't. Like the exclusion of the raccoon people basically just seems like, yeah, that just doesn't, yeah, we don't like that, so we're not going to include it. As opposed to like thinking about, you know, what market segment will that bring? What group of people is that uniquely intriguing to, or who does it push out of the game? Yeah, let's have aliens from Alien in there. Why not? That makes so much more sense than raccoon people. So in some ways, it seems like, you know, Fallout 1 and 2, and maybe people appreciate the games for that, they feel a lot more arbitrary to me than Fallout 3 does.
Absolutely.
And sometimes maybe that's good, and sometimes maybe that's bad. I'm never going to be saying that like market testing is the thing that like determines whether a game is good or not. But it seems like there is a broader context that Fallout 3 understands itself in, and that's because it is a bigger economic venture. I mean, they need to make sure it makes money.
Developer Bethesda priorities have changed.
Absolutely.
Much unlike war.
Well, war never changes. It's just not going to do it, which maybe is a good chance for us to talk about, of course, the opening narration.
Yes.
Of this game. And you've got some context for that, too, I think. Maybe we can talk about at the end here. But I'm going to read this to you, Michael. I'm going to read it kind of chunk by chunk, and you just give me your freewheeling thoughts on it. We have not talked about this off mic at all. And people who have listened to the show so far, you know we have a lot of feelings and thoughts about how weird these openings are for Fallout. So I'm going to read these chunk by chunk. You give me your unalloyed reaction, Michael. Let's talk about it. Here we go.
Okay.
War. War never changes.
All right.
Okay, good. Since the dawn of humankind, when our ancestors first discovered the killing power of rock and bone, blood has been spilled in the name of everything, from God to justice to simple psychotic rage.
I mean, there's some ideology there, but the statement is not in and of itself incorrect, I think.
It's very opening of 2001.
Exactly.
It's very, you know, the moment you discover the club is the moment that you use the club. Okay, in the year 2077... after millennia of armed conflict, the destructive nature of man could sustain itself no longer. The world was plunged into an abyss of nuclear fire and radiation.
It's interesting, the idea that humanity's propensity to endless conflict was somehow sustainable before this point. But okay, let's go on.
Well, and what's interesting, I think, about that too, right, is that all conflict of human history is reducible down to like, we're gonna fight no matter what, and we just use whatever tools that we have,
right?
Which again is the same problem as like the last two that we've talked about. There's no room for like the reasons why human beings actually like the fighting is the reason. We're just finding other excuses to do the fighting.
Yes.
Is what this suggests, right? So again,
yes.
You know, what you said, ideology, right? There's this ideology of like the war of all against all. It's very Hobbes' state of nature. But it was not, as some had predicted, the end of the world. Instead, the apocalypse was simply the prologue to another bloody chapter of human history. For man had succeeded in destroying the world. But war never changes.
So the problem here, right, is that we have claimed that this innate capacity of humans that they're constantly exercising became unsustainable, but it turns out it was extremely sustainable. Like, I'm kind of dunking on this intro, but I think, for one, I think this is a better intro than the first game's intro. I think it makes more sense.
Sure.
But it does have this problem that we've already talked about, which is, I mean, it's not even necessarily a problem, right? It is making a statement about people, about humans, whatever, in a way that the first intro did not. And I remember us talking about that, because in the intro to the first game, it was, war never changes. And then it gave a bunch of examples of historical warfare, all of which were very different and all of which happened for very different reasons. And that was a thing that we pointed out. And I know that some commenters and viewer listeners had responded and said, they had come back with this intro, right? They had made an interpretation of that intro, and it had been something like, you know, humans are constantly at war with themselves, with each other, right? It's war of all against all, which is, you know, something you can disagree with or we can debate or whatever. But it is not what that first intro says. And in a way, what is good about this intro is that it is an interpretation of that first intro in a not necessarily canny way, but it seems like, and one of the things that I read sort of outside my playtime was this interview from Gama Sutra with Emil Pagliarulo. It was an interview done by Chris Remo. Prior to Fallout 3 being released, Pagliarulo was the lead designer, I think. He was kind of the lead writer. He had been the writer for the Dark Brotherhood questline in Oblivion, and then he became the lead writer for Fallout 3. And there's a bit where he talks about re-listening to the first intro with Ron Perlman, trying to kind of, like, nail the tone. And he does not say, like, what I had to do was interpret what was being said, but it is clear that this intro is written in response to that one, and it makes slightly more sense in that it is kind of putting its ideological claim at the front, right? It's not disclosing it as ideological, but it is at least making some sort of claim about humanity that makes a lot more sense than saying war never changes, and here are three different examples of war that are all extremely distinct.
Yeah, and when we say, I just realized we didn't say this, when we say ideology, we just mean something that people believe. Mm-hmm. A coherent, or sometimes incoherent, but a set of beliefs that people have about the world that are often implicit, right? And so, for example, Michael, when you're saying that it's ideological, but it's not revealing that ideology, the implicit ideology here is that when push comes to shove between, say, community-mindedness and violence, human beings will always choose, in the last instance, violence and warfare against one another.
Right.
And that's a very particular, like, that is not a universalizable behavior, right? We have plenty of examples in history where that is not the case. There are a lot of articles that get written about, like, what actually happens when the apocalypse happens, quote-unquote. There's an Arcady Martin article that's about this. And what we find out is that people actually don't, like, you know, end up in a Mad Max world. People actually end up helping one another quite often. And in our actual contemporary examples of that. And so the ideology would be, oh, well, of course, individualist nightmare logic takes over. And then we put on our assless chaps and we fight to the death. But in fact, what happens is we just, like, give eggs to each other or whatever.
Mm-hmm. The other way of thinking about ideology is that it's anything that is being presented as kind of like the spontaneous and immediate truth of reality. Like, this is just how people are, right? If people, like, people left to their own devices are going to do this, that is very often an ideological claim.
Zizek tells the story about, I think it's Heisenberg that he tells the story about, but it doesn't really matter. It's a scientist, and the scientist is hanging out with a journalist, and they walk into his barn, and there is a horseshoe hanging up above the door, and that journalist says, "Oh, you're a man of science. Why do you have that horseshoe up there for good luck and warding off evil spirits? Why do you have that? Because obviously you don't believe that." And then the scientist turns around and he says, "Well, you don't have to believe in it for it to work."
Right.
That's ideology.
Yes.
Okay, but here's the last little bit of the opening narration.
Mm-hmm.
"In the early days, thousands were spared the horrors of the Holocaust by taking refuge in enormous underground shelters known as vaults. But when they emerged, they only had the hell of the wastes to greet them, all except those in Vault 101. For on that fateful day, when fire rained from the sky, the giant steel door of Vault 101 slid closed and never reopened. It was here you were born. It is here you will die. Because in Vault 101, no one ever enters and no one ever leaves."
And wouldn't you know it, that's exactly how the game plays out. You never leave Vault 101.
Yeah, it's pretty quick, actually. I'm surprised it took them so long to make the game.
Yeah. But for real, what I like about this bit is it calls back to kind of the thing that we've noted about the previous two intros, which is like the DM setting the table for your campaign kind of tone, right? Mm-hmm. It is here where you were born, and so on and so forth. The other thing that is interesting about the vaults is that... So a couple of things are happening here. If you have played the first two games, then you probably have an idea of why Vault 101 was never supposed to open. If this is your first Fallout game, and it is many, many people's first Fallout game, that sets up a little bit of a mystery. This is going to be a thing that you're going to play this game to find out. Like, why wasn't Vault 101 supposed to open? And how this kind of operates, right, is that... The returning player is going to think, okay, Vault 101 was never supposed to open. I played Fallout 2, so I know the vaults that weren't supposed to open, like Vault 13, were ones that are being kept in reserve for Enclave plans, or what have you. And so they can bring kind of that additional bit of context in, and their experience of this game is going to be trying to figure out how the Enclave is going to fit in, and so on and so forth. Whereas the new player just has this additional bit of mystique about the setting and so on. And we've got this kind of conflation of concerns from the first game, Fallout 1, with Vault 13. You know, the vault is opening and you have to go out and so on and so forth. But then also Fallout 2 of kind of... There is a community, and this community is fragile and threatened by some kind of, like, outside force or power structure or what have you. The thing I'm trying to get at is I don't think we had this language when Fallout 3 came out, but we have it now. This is a soft reboot.
Mm-hmm.
Would you agree? Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I think that, it's kind of the, when you were just talking about, or maybe you said it off mic, I don't know if you just repeated it just now, I don't think you did, but that there were kind of active choices being made about what was being kept from Fallout 2 and what was being kept in Fallout 3. I don't think you did. Can you say that little piece from the article about like the tone of Fallout 2 versus Fallout 3?
Right. So another bit from this this interview with Pagliarulo, he talks about here when he sort of the challenge of making a third game in this franchise, which has a kind of history for a certain tone of writing. And he essentially says, oh, yes. So actually, the question puts this well. What about the separate challenge of writing for a sequel that is being made by none of its original creators and that has gained something of a mythical status, even among a lot of gamers who never played the original titles? And he responds, being completely honest, you don't. You don't try to. When you try to, you're setting yourself up to fail. You have to be confident in your abilities and do the best you can do. We looked at Fallout 1 as our model. It's interesting to me. I will lurk a lot in the forums. Never post, but see. And one of the things you hear a lot is when we released a couple of dialogue screenshots, oh, these dialogue options are too short. Well, if you look in a lot of Todd Howard, executive producer, pokes his head into interview, Emil lies. And then they kind of like have to laugh this off. Thanks, Todd Howard. And he retracts. But really, if you look in Fallout, there are a lot of short dialogue options. So you're right, there is a bit of mythical quality there. But we really looked at Fallout 1 as our model. It's all about giving players a choice and giving the player the voice they want to use. We backed away from the stuff in Fallout 2, the more campy, pop culturally stuff. So yeah. The sort of the weirder tone of Fallout 2 is something that is being actively avoided here.
So I think in the context of that is how we can understand the soft reboot question, because mm-hmm. it's not just like a soft reboot of canon, because I think what's so interesting is that you know, for example, that timeline that we were talking about from the Fallout Bible, like that piece of empirical data more or less stays unchanged. The years shift a little bit, but I think like the events and the procession of events is more or less unchanged. But it's a question of in the same way that like Batman Begins, and I think this is where your question is coming from, or your statement is coming from, Batman Begins has all the pieces of Batman that we think are cool, but it is different from Batman and Robin.
Mm-hmm.
In a significant kind of way. And I think that's the logic here, right? I mean, I think that at that point in like cinema, we have the beginnings of the run of soft reboots and just normal reboots and remakes that we would have over the next, you know, 10 years or so. And those were fundamentally about looking at source material and then looking at how you could rewrite source material in such a way to keep the things that people really enjoyed, but to then seriousify or maturify or make, you know, I don't know, make more artsy mm-hmm. the final object itself, right? I in its base assumptions, Batman Begins is not that different from the Schumacher Batman things, but it is the tone in which those things are communicated that make them fundamentally mm-hmm. different. And I think the same thing's happening here. The basic assumptions are overwhelmingly the same, but it is the tone from which they are approached and the kind of bounds of the final object that are different. And weirdly enough, that gets stranger with the DLCs, I think, in some interesting ways, but we will talk about that when we get there. Tell me about being a little baby, Michael.
So, we begin, and we are born. You get born, this is, so, one of the things that I think is interesting here from like a writerly perspective is just the temptation of the vaults is too great, right? It is an environment that is great for creating a video game player character because it is going to give you a chance to have someone who is just completely outside of the world that they're interacting with, right? In kind of this fundamental way. And this game is very funny to me because we are going to pursue that from the beginning. I get born, and I'm a beautiful baby girl, and my father names me Eleanor, and for some reason puts, threes where those E's should be, but, that's, yeah. I forgot that how you design your character is that you are born as a baby and then your dad pulls down like this magic like time progression machine to give you a view of what you're going to look like when you grow up. And this is another thing that I think is notable about this particular game is that you know, we're in first person perspective. Actually, I should say that the game begins. You're in first person perspective. You've got, you know, blood splattered in your field of vision because you were born. You're a baby. But that first person perspective allows you to look at kind of the material culture of this world in a way that Fallout 1 and 2 didn't. And so it allows something like your dad to pull down this really bizarre, like, TV from the ceiling that is going to show you what you're going to look like when you're 20 years old now that you are, you know, 5 seconds old. And already we have this kind of, like, there's, like, in and of itself, right, that is wackier in a way, right? It's like retro future wacky in a way that the first two games gestured at, but they could never be wacky in quite this way, because the game itself is not pointing out that, like, oh, this is stupid and it's a video game, or this is stupid and so wacky. It is funny to me as the player that this is the world that I'm entering into, right?
Yeah, there are some I think when you focus in on them, there are big differences, but I think just in the moment to moment of the game, they are subtle differences that are really important here. And I think that's one that you're pointing to that's really, really good. We understood the, like, material culture, as you just said, or, you know, the pieces of, you know, technology that they have, the way they live their life. We understood those things implicitly in Fallout 1 and 2, and we understood them implicitly through the interface for the most part. So when you clicked on, you know, when you talked to someone and you got the weird kind of TV screen looking thing in front of you, that gave us this idea that, like, there's a retro future going on, or, you know, there's technology, but it's kind of beat up and it's old and it kind of sucks and it, like, doesn't look too good. That's how we understood the kind of, like, flavor of tech in the world. That's a big part of it. Here... Or for the other one, I guess, that's in the older games, is when you look at the Pip-Boy in your menu, right? You are physically looking at, or presumably you're physically looking at, this thing that is on your wrist. And so we get kind of both of those things going on here. But the difference is that instead of, like, us as a player seeing it through the interface, we are presumably seeing everything in this game through the eyes of the character. And I think that really changes the relationship between us and that technology. Because, again, I think you're right, that it gives us the opportunity to, like, kind of be like, what is this machine? What is this,
right,
like, future progression machine? And it's treated as completely normal, as opposed to, like, the first two games where we wouldn't question the interface, right? There's no reason for us to think that we know that it's an abstraction, right? We don't think we're looking through the first person of someone's eyeballs, because we know our 3D, our little character is, like, isometrically projected down there. But here, there's an alignment of player and character in a way that there is not an alignment of player and character in the first two games. And yet we get similar information communicated to us in both of those different modes.
And then your mom dies.
Yep. Off screen.
Well, you get to see her leg.
You get to see her leg. She calls you. She called Tonk, who you know, was put together. No numbers, just Tonk. Tonk gets put together there, and she called him handsome or something like that. And then she dies immediately. But, you know, entering us into a period of the datification of games.
Yes, actually, that is also a thing that is going on. So, yeah, after you are born and your mother more or less immediately dies after you create your character or your physical appearance, right, then we move into the second aspect of the beginning of the game, which is really the beginning of the game, but also character creation and also kind of tutorial.
Yeah. This is this whole opening vault segment of the game, and shocker, you don't spend your whole life inside the vault. You don't die there. But yeah, this whole section is just like a, kind of a tutorial for both the systems of the game and the kind of play space of Fallout 3. Like, what kind of actions can you expect to be doing in Fallout 3? That, you know, and this is giving us kind of a big, you know, like a Long John Silver sampler platter. Which I haven't had in 15 years, but I bet probably is delicious. it's giving you that, but for, you know, your Kroger or your Publix veggie plate. Got that big bowl of ranch in the middle. That's what we're getting here.
Right. So, like, the screen whites out and you flash forward and now you're in the toddler phase and you get to see your dad's face. And your dad's face gets retroactively remodeled based on the face that you chose for your character.
I know that his race is ambiguous until you choose your character.
Yes.
And then based on your skin tone, his skin tone changes.
Yeah. And he's standing there and he's trying to teach you to walk. So you get to walk around and you get little dialogue, or not dialogue, but action prompts that show you like, how do you pick up an item in the world without, like, putting, like, you don't have an inventory yet, but how do you pick something up, like, within the space of the world and move it around? Because you have little baby toys that you can move around, and you can open and close the gate to your baby pen, and so on and so forth. Something that I think we talked about this in the Fallout Bible episode, you mentioned that Darius Kazemi had talked to us about how the manuals for the original games were a great example of what people are talking about when they're talking about Fallout tone, right? That kind mm-hmm. of like weird flip, tone and approach to the material and character creation and like all of the Vault Tech stuff. And what is interesting about this entire opening section is that it folds all of that into the game itself for the first time, because then we have to read our little baby book that allows us to create our characters.
Yeah, what gets talked about so often is the tone of Fallout 1 and 2 and the approach to humor in Fallout 1 and 2 is actually all here at the beginning of Fallout 3. Mm-hmm. It's actually really strange to me that we talk so much about, and anyone who's listened to the show knows that we have run this question into the ground, and it's going to keep coming up, I'm sure, in fits and spurts over the course of the thing, but, you know, big question, Fallout 1 and 2, are they satire? We've talked about that quite a bit, but to me what's interesting is that here in the vault at the very beginning, I think there's a lot more actual, legitimate, purposeful satire than there ever was in Fallout and Fallout 2. And so that's a little bit strange to me too, but I don't think I saw that in this section. It's in the next one. But yeah, we open up our baby book and we get to use that baby book. It's the Vault Boy, and he's teaching us about like all of our different abilities. Mm-hmm. And so immediately gives us this idea that everything in the vault is touched by Vault Tech. Like it all yes. passes through. All of everyone's lives are passing through the entity, the corporate entity that is Vault Tech, which I think, you know, for people who have played Fallout 1 and 2 and especially played through the end of Fallout 2 and got the idea that the vaults are experiments, basically, for them, you know, for me when I'm playing, I'm like, oh yeah, like this is something we never got a perspective on in the actual games of Fallout 1 and 2, which is like, you are the product of pure ideology, pure Vault Tech corporate speech mm-hmm. and thinking. If you grow up in the vault, what does your stats look like?
My stats are wrong, first of all. I'm actually going to have to rebuild my character, I think, because I was not thinking and I didn't realize I could take skill. Like, I didn't realize I could take points out that had already been assigned. So I tried to build, as Eleanor has been up until this point, stealthy and speechy and small guns, right? Sort of like shooty, that kind of combat focused, but like more lighter combat focused. So I created a character and did not get the distribution I wanted, but that's just because I was coming at this and could not remember how to work really like the interface or anything like that. It was kind of interesting how alien the entire like layout of this felt to me here at the beginning, coming off of, I mean, the games that I've been playing the most of for the past 2 years have been Fallout 1 and 2 and like No Man's Sky. So,
it's a weird interface in general sense, right? I mean, the even the thing that you were just talking about a minute ago, that like Fallout 3 immediately, the first interaction that it gives you are
mm-hmm.
Walking around in 3D space, jumping, pressing E to scream like a baby.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you noticed that, but you can just wail yes. on that E key and you can yell mm-hmm. like a baby the whole time. E to manipulate and open and close things, and then picking things up physically in the world, which is like important for, weirdly enough, is a big part of Bethesda games, but serves no gameplay purpose. It's purely for like your own pleasure to do so. I don't think there's ever been a time in a Bethesda game where I've had to pick something up and put it somewhere for a gameplay purpose. It's almost entirely through, you know, hitting the E key and interacting. But yeah, and so then it gives you this weird kind of book where you can like go up and down. But Tonk ended up being, classic Tonk, went up to 9 strength, went up to, I think, 8 endurance. And I swerved a little bit here because, you know, historically, Tonk has tried to do some science. and has been punished for doing so.
That is true, yes.
No longer. Tonk does not believe in science any longer. And so I took some points out of intelligence, took some points out of, I think I left agility alone. I took some points out of some other places to give them to strength, endurance, and luck. Because I think it's going to be important. Luck in this game really controls like critical hits and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's going to be important for Tonk to get those crits in.
Actually, you know what? Maybe I'm just going to stick with the stats that I picked, right? That will be this generation's penance for the way that Twelinor broke reality back in Fallout 2. It's like you had to be perfectly average and then slightly above average in three different skills or attributes or whatever.
And the thing here too, right? This is something that's also a little bit different from the previous two Fallout games. Is in the previous two Fallout games, you can improve your stats, but they were always in weird technological and very in-game and in-world things. We didn't really engage in any of that. But in Vault City, you could get some implants that would increase your abilities, and somewhere else too, maybe New Reno, you could do that in Fallout 2. And we never did that, but in this game, you just find bobbleheads. There's little bobbleheads that just give you an arbitrary skill up. Some are for skills, and some are for your special abilities. And little Fallout 3 tip for everyone, never give yourself a 10 in any ability, or any special attribute, because you can always go find the bobblehead that gives you one additional point.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to... It's a little bit of strategy for you. But so we do that. Your dad tells you about a quote from Revelations.
This is so funny, and I have no idea how it's supposed to land. I do not know what the intent behind this was, but like as a little tiny toddler, you turn around from your father, and like one of the first things you see is this massive cross stitch sampler of a quote from the Book of Revelation.
Yeah, it's a quote about the water of life. We'll learn more about that later. We haven't said this yet, but your father is Liam Neeson.
Oh, yeah.
That's all we need to say about it, I guess.
It's like, kinda, it's ironically, he gets taken.
Well, yeah, that doesn't happen in this next segment, though.
I know. No. Sorry, I jumped the gun there.
The next segment is a birthday party.
Mm-hmm. You're 10 years old.
You're 10 years old. And you got a birthday party. We learn about some other people in the vault. And basically, this is the vast majority of the population of the vault that we end up meeting over the next, like, 30 minutes. There is Amata,
mm-hmm.
who is the daughter of the Overseer. There's a kid named Butch, who's, like, a little rude dude.
Mm-hmm.
There's your dad. There is the guy who's like the mechanic, the engineer.
Yeah, Stanley.
Stanley. Yeah. There is Andy, the Mr. Handy robot.
Mm-hmm.
And then some other kids.
Mm-hmm.
And an older woman who gives you a sweet roll.
Yes. Yes. Old Lady Palmer.
Mm-hmm. And they're all here basically to like give you an excuse. To learn how to do the conversation system. Basically, yes. Your dad tells you, hey, I've got something to give you, but you need to go, like, work the room first, basically.
Yes.
and so you just have to talk to everybody, and this is teaching you, this is how the conversation system works. And to be quite frank, I don't find this conversation system to be all that different from Fallout 2.
No, I was so surprised. So one of the things that I was talking about back in the prior two games is that really the secret to writing a Fallout dialogue tree is that every response has three flavors: nice, nice but not too nice, or raging asshole. And anything bigger than that is just basically like different flavors of being a jerk. And it's kind of the same here.
Yeah, there is not a substantial difference. The difference, of course, being or a key difference being that they're not as long. Like, that's true. I think there are very few of them that go on to two lines. I think there are a couple that do, but not very many of them. And so I can see if you were one of the people who really love those like three or four line long form answers that Tonk never got access to because he didn't have high enough intelligence. but if you like those, right, that kind of Eleanor responses, then you might be missing that here. But like, as far as like in concept, like you're saying, and like in design application, not that different.
Yeah, no, it's very, very similar. And you just kind of get a sense of like who the, like what this does that I think is nice is it gives you a sense that there is like people living in the vault, like that there is a community here. And there's like a bit where you can go over and there's like a bulletin board where people are posting about like, you know, lost and found, or do you want a tarot reading? See Beatrice, that sort of thing. There's also a marquee, a scrolling marquee on one of the walls. I don't know if you noticed this, but it has kind of like general messages from the overseer or what have you. And one of them is like, America lives on in you, which is, right, that like, it's a little suture that pulls together like Vault Tech and the Nationalist Project in a way that got revealed at the end of Fallout 2, but hadn't really been apparent up until then, right? So there, again, it's that material culture, being able to look at the things in the world and differentiate between the people who live there, which of course is a huge difference. It's not like the first two games could have done this or should have done this. That's not the argument that I'm making. But I think probably for people who started playing this game here, or like playing this franchise here, this is set up to foster a very different relationship and way of thinking about the world just in general than the first two games. And I think that's worth noting.
Yeah. We're never going to encounter some of the weirder things that we found in the previous game. So, for example, I'm thinking about the graffiti. Couldn't come up with the word graffiti. The graffiti in New Reno that's like class of 2020 rules or whatever.
Uh-huh.
Which Jet is just
rules.
Like... Yes, Jet is good. Like, those pieces of, like, art and world building that seem to have no connection to what we're doing, like, even a little bit, like, there's none of that here. It seems that everything is flowing into a focus of, like, what we're supposed to be taking from this moment in this place, which is these people exist in the vault. The vault is tied into an American national identity, and we have to, like, piece together who each person is and how they fit into that puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so we talked to people. There's some notable things here. The older woman gives you a sweet roll, and you can like have it, and then it leads you into a confrontation with Butch, who's like a bully. I got that sweet roll and immediately ate it. Like immediately jumped into my inventory, scarfed that thing down, and he was so disappointed that he couldn't steal it from me.
He asked for it, and I spit on it and gave it to him.
Dang. But yes, yeah, so you can have conversations here. Obviously, Amada is like your very good friend. The overseer is like a huge jerk. Cause I asked him, I was like, why didn't you help your daughter throw this party for me? And he was like, I can't give any more resources to anything because I'm the overseer. I have to be fair. And so you get a very clear, immediate, you know, relationship between this jerk and like everyone who lives here is in this room, so you know,
yeah,
holding on to that hierarchy is a little bit weird. We also, because we're 10 years old in this moment, we get our Pip-Boy and we get to learn how to use our inventory there basically. But after that, we get the, after we talk to all these people, we get our present from our dad,
mm-hmm,
from Liam Neeson. We go down, we meet his like friend slash co-worker Jonas. Jonas gives us a BB gun.
Mm-hmm.
And then we learn combat in the game.
Yes, combat tutorial.
Yeah, quite different than Fallout previous. It's not turn-based.
If you don't want it to be, is maybe the way of putting it. VATS is not exactly turn-based, but it's interesting, right? I like VATS a lot. I will say that. I like VATS, yeah, in the first-person games. Like, it is just, I like this style of combat. I play FPS games, like, you know, wheeling around, shooting, so on and so forth. But I kind of like this, like, pause, like, choose your target, fire, and you get to watch it. Like, there's something nice about the way that it introduces the like, or rather, I guess, reintroduces the abstraction, or like a kind of the abstraction of the regular turn-based combat from the previous two games. I don't know if you feel similar, and I'll have more VATS thoughts.
No, I think VATS is great. I think VATS should be in all Bethesda games, basically, because, like, what VATS is doing here is, I think, on one hand, right, it's gesturing back into the turn-based combat of, like, you know, right-clicking and choosing to shoot people in the eyeballs and stuff like that. On one hand, it's doing that, but on the other hand, it is saying and owning up to the fact that Bethesda combat and Bethesda game design does not make for good tactical stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, it is just, it's hard to manage five or six different enemies in a Bethesda game, and that is true across every single game that they have made. It's just hard to handle that many things due to the speed of the combat and the kind of clunkiness of it and things like that. And so it's really great, and it gives them a wider ability, or gives them a little bit more flexibility when it comes to combat design, because you can always create a combat scenario in which there's six or seven or eight enemies, and I can go into that and immediately hit my VATS button and, like, kill one or two of those enemies immediately. And then I can kind of pick and choose and wait for my VATS, my action points to come back up, and then I can go back into that system again. So I think it's great. I mean, I think playing a Fallout game without ever using VATS is like missing something that mm-hmm. is good about the Bethesda Fallout games. And I don't think there's like any virtue, like inherent virtue to their combat system by itself. So yeah, I like it. I think it's good. I think this is the first, I'm playing it at a very high frame rate, like an extremely high frame rate. And so it is interesting to like, to feel like I'm in a Call of Duty game, like using this little, BB gun, like switching targets very quickly with like a high DPI mouse. Because this is the first time I'm going to be playing the game all the way through on PC. I played this game when it came out, but I played it on Xbox 360, and I've played it through more than one time on the Xbox 360. So it's interesting to like get the ability to say use a mouse, which is very, very different. And I guess I should say that too, right? That probably is a reason why VATS is implemented in such a way in this game, is that it's not just for managing different numbers of enemies and things like that, but it's for managing a not that tuned first person shooter on the console space.
Mm-hmm. And I'm using a controller to play, just I guess for the record. If you notice, in there should be footage for my playthrough now for the first time. I have gameplay footage that should be incorporated, assuming everything goes according to plan. And view a listener, if you happen to notice that I'm in VATS and I'm like having a hell of a time with a rad roach, just like highlighting different parts of it, it's because I can't get the analog stick to highlight the part that I want it to.
Hmm. Classic VATS problem. Mm-hmm. Just accidentally selecting a different enemy while you're trying to do that. But
yeah.
So we do that. We learn how to do that. We shoot the rad roach, and then we zip forward in time again.
Mm-hmm. Now we're 16.
Now we're 16, and we gotta learn what kind of job we're gonna have.
Mm-hmm. We're, for some reason, faking sick to our father because we don't want to learn what kind of job we're going to get, I guess.
Yeah, we have to take the GOAT exam, which is like an aptitude test. Which is, again, like, this is another segment in all the questions that we're gonna get. These are a lot more, like, openly satirical.
Yes.
Than any of the rest of the Fallout games. But the thing I wanted to mention before about like the relationship between Vault Tech and nationalism, there's a poster on your wall in this section of the game that is like a white middle class 1950s family who are having a picnic and playing baseball on like an idyllic hill with like a blue, perfect blue sky behind them, and superimposed on top of them in that blue sky is like a ghostly vault boy with his like arms on his hips, and it's just like everything, it's you know, pure Americana with all the racial and political implications and economic implications of that, but instead of Uncle Sam or something like that, it's the vault boy. And that's when I was like, oh yeah, like this is so much more aesthetically and ideologically coherent. Not good, right? I think that this kind of nationalism, corporate nationalism, is absolutely being critiqued here, but it is so much more coherent and readable than it ever mm-hmm. has been in any of the other games. But But yeah, so when we're on our way to the goat, Michael, there's a little bit of an encounter that happens.
Tunnel snakes rule.
Tunnel snakes rule.
So it's a meme. Butch, who has founded his own little gang of greasers called the Tunnel Snakes, they are harassing our friend Amata, for basically no reason other than that they're jerks, and I guess she's the overseer's daughter, I don't know. But I talked with all of them, and none of them could give me a good reason for why they were doing it, and eventually I just, like, when I talked to Butch, I told him to stop, and I passed a speech check, and he did.
Tonk is unhinged in this universe. Tonk has made already some absolutely wild decisions in the vault. And it's partially just to explore, like, what can you do in this Bethesda game, mm-hmm. right? Like, I know that in a previous Fallout game, I could just choose to shoot anyone I wanted. You know, mm-hmm. regardless of the consequences, I could choose to do that, and I would have to reap the whirlwind if it went bad, right? Mm-hmm. And so, as soon as the section began, Tonk whipped out his fist and just started punching his own dad in the head, like, as much as possible. Like,
Eleanor did shoot her dad with a BB gun.
And so, you know, I'm just doing that. I'm picking him up and putting him on the examination table to see, like, what will happen. Because when you do that, he just goes unconscious. He doesn't die because he's a protected NPC. Mm-hmm. Which has been, you know, introduced into Bethesda games in Oblivion, I believe. And so yes. I'm like bopping him in the head, boom, 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 critting him every couple hits. And he's like, oh, stop doing that. I brought you into this world and you know the rest. And I'm just clunking on him. But he, you know, so I see what happens there. He doesn't take that well. And so when I hear, when Tonk hears Butch saying the things that he is saying to Amata, which are very sexually explicit and gross. Oh, yes. They're bad. Like, it's mm-hmm. She is being sexually harassed.
Yes.
Doesn't stop to initiate dialogue. Just charges up a punch and gets right in there. Boom, 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 boom. Bop, 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 bop. Punching all the tunnel snakes in the head. Defeats them in combat. He says, oh, I gotta get out of here. This isn't even worth it. You know, says something rude to me. And he goes into the classroom. And then Tonk follows. So no speech check, just a good old-fashioned, biceps check. The kind that Tonk loves. But then I took the goat. How was the goat for Eleanor?
Oh, it was fine. As you said, these questions are, clearly sort of ironic, satirical. Like, all this entire test is a vault tech thing, right? Like, it is about creating people who are going to fit within the vault ecosystem as it has been designed by this corporation at this point, like, 200 years ago, right? And it's, you know, wacky stuff about, like, oh, if you have a mutation, like, what do you do? Or I can't think of a specific one off the top of my head to really, like, fully recount. But I will say, like, some of them are clear, right? It's like, here's a situation. Are you more inclined to take, like, an active aggressive approach? Are you going to take a diplomatic approach? Or are you going to take a kind of, like, sneaky indirect approach? There are also questions that I have no idea exactly what they're measuring. But at the end, the point is that based on the way you have answered these questions, the game is going to recommend for you which skills you should tag, mm-hmm. which is much friendlier than anything in Fallout 1 and 2, in the sense that, like, Fallout 1 and 2, you could tag various skills, but it was not clear what those were going to do for you. Or rather, it could be clear, but it wasn't going to be clear, maybe how, like, what was it we were talking about back during Fallout 2? Like, the outdoorsman skill, right? Mm-hmm. And how You could just choose the outdoorsman skill at the beginning and pump a bunch of stuff into outdoorsman, and this would affect how your random encounters worked in that game. But there was nothing that was telling you really that that's how that was going to play out, and that in fact, unless you do the unless you tag the skill or like pump up the skill in some way, you're just going to have a hell of a time with random encounters, right? There's not really a clear connection between these skills and sort of how they're going to affect your play experience, whereas this is clearly trying to make that connection for the player.
Yeah. And I think this is a good development on the, you know, Morrowind, and I think Oblivion too, right? The questionnaires that you could do there that would basically help you choose your class.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, in keeping with the spirit of Fallout, no classes in Fallout, right? I can't choose to be a spell sword or whatever. Mm-hmm. But you can, you know, kind of angle your answers into that. So like I pulled up the questions here. The one you were referring to. Oh no, you've been exposed to radiation and a mutated hand has grown out of your stomach. What's the best course of treatment? And then you can choose one, a bullet to the brain, two, mm-hmm. large doses of anti-mutagen agent, three, prayer, maybe God will spare you in exchange for a life of pious devotion, which actually tags barter, by the way, which is really weird, and okay. Four, removal of the mutated tissue with a precision laser.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they're a little bit, you know, they're goofy questions a little bit, but they are testing for something. Question 10, of course, is my favorite.
Yes, of course. You want to read that one? Do you have that one up?
Who is indisputably the most important person in Vault 101? He who shelters us from the harshness of the atomic wasteland and to whom we owe everything we have, including our lives. One, the Overseer. Two, the Overseer. Three, the Overseer. And four, the Overseer.
And again, right, there's sort of more humor here, more coherent humor about, like, what is the Vault, right? What is the world of the Vault? What is the Vault doing? We've already had our interactions with the Overseer and know he's kind of a jerk, but then we also get this question, and whether or not he specifically put it there, it gives us this sense that, you know, this entire educational apparatus is for producing people who are going to make the Vault continue to function.
Yep, 100%. And it is so much more clear here than in any of the previous games. What did you get? What is your position?
I absolutely do not remember because I just switched it over to small guns, speech, and sneak.
Yeah, I got explosives, melee weapons, and repair, because in this game it has a repair system, and if I'm hitting things with a baseball bat the whole game, I'm going to want that thing to be at maximum damage capability.
Yeah, that's a good outlook.
For when I inevitably have to like fight people in power armor with a baseball bat. I got a fry cook. That's my like answer thing.
Oh, that. Okay. No, mm-hmm. I thought you meant like, what were the ones that assigned me? The teacher, whose name, by the way, is Mr. Brotch.
Yeah.
he told me that I was on like the supervisor track or something.
Mm.
So I could be the overseer one day, I guess.
Great. He told me I was going to be a fry cook. And then he said, he was like, I'm only going to tell you this one time. He's like, extra mustard and no pickles.
Wow.
And then I was like, well, I always wanted to be a fry cook. But this is another, so, you know, I've evoked Fallout ideology, and this is something I evoked in the last couple episodes of Fallout 2 as well, about the kind of implicit belief in, like, intelligence being good or hierarchizing people around intelligence. This is just another example. That has cleanly jumped its way over into Fallout 3 of, like, if you're a fry cook, that is somehow a lower job. Because he definitely treats you kind of like like you're of the servant class immediately. And it's like, that, you know, that's bad. That is not, like, a cultural value that I appreciate at all. Being a fry cook is should be a respected job, the same as all other jobs. But so that hierarchizing of jobs and capability around intelligence is like very easily made the jump here.
Mm-hmm.
But then that's the end of this section.
Yeah. I mean, I was sure to note that for some reason on the chalkboard, they're discussing Charles Dickens's novel Bleak House, which I mean, I guess it's what they're reading in school. It's a very interesting choice here because I have read Bleak House, and it has very little to do with anything in this game. So it's just like, what would they be reading at high school level? I guess Bleak House.
It's in the public domain. That's a huge part of it. Vault-Tec didn't have to license it.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that actually makes a lot of sense. So then this...
you got to think like a corporation here.
So then this section ends, and we are like immediately thrust into the nightmare of it.
Yeah. So this is like, you know, it's a couple years later, and Amato wakes us up and is like, "Hey, you know," and there's a lot of small pieces to this, but she basically says, "Hey, guess what? Even though no one comes in or out of this vault, your dad just left. He opened up the main door. He got out. It's made my dad, the overseer, super pissed off. He already killed Jonas. He's looking for you to kill you. Just FYI, let's get you the heck out of here. Here's the key to his office. You can use his escape route to get to the front door of the vault, and you can leave." And then she tries to give me a gun, and I said, "You keep that gun." Because I could see a baseball bat right over her shoulder. And I said, "Oh, I'm good. I'm going to get that bad boy."
Oh, I took that gun.
Yeah. No, I told her to keep it. I said, you can do that. And then we could just escape the vault. It's the vault. I guess when Liam Neeson opened up the vault, it let in a bunch of rad roaches. So there's rad roaches running around, which are just giant roaches. And we escaped the vault. Anything interesting happened to you in the middle here?
I run out and I fight some rad roaches. There's a security officer, I think Officer Kendall, who is fighting the rad roaches. I help him kill the rad roaches, and then he immediately turns on me. So Eleanor shoots him to death with her BB gun, which is a thing you can do in the Fallout universe. BB guns are lethal.
Takes a while.
It sort of did. But then she was so horrified at what she had done, right? She has taken a human life, that she recommitted herself to the stealth route for as long as that's going to be feasible. I snuck around. I ran into Butch, who demanded that I help him despite us not having anything like a good relationship. Did you run into Butch?
I did. Butch rolls out and he says, "Hey, my mom's being attacked by rad roaches. Save her."
Yeah. I told him that he was bigger than the rad roaches and he should go fight them. And he did. I passed a speech check and he did that. And then I followed him because I was like, well, I did just murder someone. So let's make sure, I guess, that Butch's mom doesn't die. Which, by the way, earlier when Butch demands your sweet roll, you can say something really nasty to him about how his mother is an alcoholic. So there's that kind of context here. So I go in, and as you follow him, he's like, "Oh, you're coming too? Very, very bright." And then his mom is just sitting on the floor of her bedroom being attacked by rad roaches, and we killed those, and he was so thrilled that I helped him out that he gave me his Tunnel Snakes outfit.
Yeah, I mean, Chonk never forgets, much like an elephant, and so Chonk reflected back on all of the awful things Butch had done, all the harassment and violence that Butch had done. Tonk reached a bit into the future and learned from the Overseer's terminal that Butch and his crew like do bad stuff for the Overseer. Anything that's like nasty that the security people won't do, they do it for him. And so reflecting on all of that information, said, "Yes, I'll save your mother." And Tonk went in and saved Butch's mother, came out. Butch is very thankful. And then immediately Tonk went into Vats and smashed Butch to death with a baseball bat.
All right.
Tunnel Snakes rule.
So, yeah, then you run around some more. You see, like, two people who try to also escape the vault. It's like a man and a woman who are like, "We're going to make a run for it," or whatever. And then they run to the door and they both get shot. You can sneak around a little bit more. I ran into another officer who told me that, you know, I had to get going. He was lucky. It was Officer Gomez, I think. Who tells me, you know, you should get going. You're lucky I'm the one who found you. It's not clear. Like, no one knows exactly why your dad left, nor is it clear why the Overseer is responding so strongly to this. I found Jonas's body, along with a note from Dad, mm-hmm. who is talking about all of the, I don't know, all of the things. It's exposition, but also it's not very clear exposition. He's got some sort of important work to do, but he does not think you should follow him. Please do not follow him. However, we are following him.
The call to adventure is making us do it.
Uh-huh, right. And I ran across Amada being interrogated by her father and one of the other security officers. And her father, who is, again, just a huge piece of crap, is like, oh, I don't want to do, like, you don't understand, Amada, I don't want to do this, but it's for the safety of the vault, blah, 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 blah. And I snuck past them, stole a bunch of stuff from their rooms, like some bobby pins and some things, you know, little bits of supplies. And then I hacked the computer in the overseer's room, which is, it's interesting that the overseer's offices are now at the top of the vault, whereas in the previous games, they were always at the very bottom.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, I learned some stuff from, as you said, once you hack the overseer's computer, you can learn some stuff, specifically, like, about the tunnel snakes, and how the overseer is using them to do his dirty work, which touches on something, a conversation you can have with Amada earlier, which is like, why isn't your dad doing anything about the tunnel snakes? You also find out that there's a woman in the vault named Beatrice, who we didn't mention, who gives you a poem for your birthday, and it's this weird, like, ecstatic, like, death ode about the overseer. I don't know what is exactly supposed to, like, it's weird. It's like, all right, thanks, lady, bye. But the overseer clearly sees her as, like, mentally ill and a potential problem. So he talks about, like, how they need to medicate her to keep her under wraps.
Mm-hmm.
We also learn that throughout kind of the vault's history, despite the fact that supposedly Vault 101 is never supposed to open and people are never supposed to leave, they've been sending out scouts who have found out that radiation is down enough that you can go outside without immediately dying. There are giant ants. In case you were, I guess, doubtful of this, the game allows you to look in an attachment to this message to see a screenshot of a giant ant. There's also a settlement nearby called Megaton, and we get to see a picture of that. And then we see also the overseer's orders from Dr. Braun, sort of the lead of, like, human experimentation or whatever at Vault-Tec, with the, basically, you know, like, you know, congratulations on being the overseer of the vault, blah, 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 blah. You are in charge of a control group, which is a thing that makes sense if you've played Fallout 2. We know that the Enclave is all about these vault control groups. But then also this means, you know, no one can enter, no one can leave. Also, check the attached message to see if your vault got a Gek. This vault did not get a Gek.
Yeah, and then there's like an explainer document about what a Gek is, in case you're curious.
Yeah, an interesting thing here, the explainer document for what the Gek is says it is a terraforming module. Mm-hmm. And to go back to the Fallout Bible, the previous episode, whether or not the Gek was a terraforming module was a thing that got discussed there, and it was a thing that Chris Avalon came out very strong against, because this was bound up within the question of, like, how fantastical and wacky was the technology of the pre-war world? And so someone asks, because the fans are like, well, clearly the Garden of Eden creation kit is some sort of advanced terraforming module. And Avalon explains, like, oh, no, it's actually not that. It's basically like a collection of various types of preserved seeds and, like, schematics for irrigation canals and various stuff, right? It's a much more practical kind of a collection of information, allegedly. It's not terraforming in the way that it is explicitly presented as here.
Yeah, it's not like a thing that you open up and it, like, produces a world in front of you, mm-hmm. except it is. Take that. similar kind of deal. I mean, I wasn't sneaking anywhere, and so when I ran up to where the overseer and the security officer were, they just came out and attacked me, and so I smashed them apart with my smashing devices, and Amada could not deal with that. She did not like that I smashed her dad apart. Because he told me he was going to kill me. What am I going to do? I'm Tonk. Yeah. I got two modes, smashing and not smashing.
Right.
I don't have a third mode called running. So I did that, and then, yeah, read all those documents, went through the tunnel, and then got to the end of the vault, opened up that door. Amada came back, and she was like, hey, you know, you're my best friend, but you did kill my dad, and he was my only family, and that's bad, so you need to get out of here. And I'm locking this door behind you.
Did you see how Amada got out there?
No.
Neither did I, because what happens, and I don't know how it's going to look in your game, and maybe the viewers can see this in my footage, Amada just, like, appears on the, like, porch of the vault or something. She, like, glitched out or something like that, and when I talk to her, she basically explains, like, she kind of suggests, like, you know, why didn't you help me when I was being interrogated? And my response was, you know, my first response, which is something like, you know, I couldn't risk it or something like that. When the actual answer I would want to give would be something like, I literally do not want to kill your father in front of you. Like, that's just, that's not a, like, I'm currently having a dark night of the soul because I, you know, already killed a man. I'm not going to follow that up with killing the father of my best friend. Like, that's not how Eleanor rolls. But then she said, you know, well, I understand, right? I guess it would have been a little much to ask you to save me or something. And then the guards show up, and I run out through the vault.
Whew. And, yeah, so the door locked behind me. I went and tried to open the door back up, but it wouldn't work. Mm-hmm. And then walked out to the blinding light of the wasteland. And then I saved my game and turned it off.
I saved right before I opened the door.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Well, there's some blinding light over there.
Mm-hmm. Can I say, I really like how the vault doors look in first person. Like, it's a really good effect.
Yeah, they clearly, like, looked very carefully at, like, how the mechanism worked in the original games. Because I think they're largely identical. I could be wrong, but to my mind, they're largely identical. If they are not identical, then they have captured the, like, vibe of it to such a good degree that it still works. So yeah, I think they look really cool. I thought the beginning of this game was great. I think that it is doing, you know, I mean, I think I just land on the side of, like, they picked all the right stuff to mimic from the first two games, and it makes for a really, at least, interesting opening of the game. Although we are, in the next episode, we're going to go to Megaton and do some quests there, which is a little town right outside. It's not really a spoiler. Mm-hmm. You can see it from the vault if you look. And we're going to do that, and then we'll see how much of the, you know, what's the difference, what's Fallout 3 doing differently, and then what Fallout 3 has in store. Any final thoughts here, Michael?
No, I believe I covered everything in my notes.
Okay. Well, you got anything to plug?
I do not.
Where can people find you on the internet?
You can find me on Twitter at WarrenIsDead.
You can go to twitter.com/rangetouch in order to see what we're doing. We got all kinds of stuff in the works and things coming out. The first episode of Just King Things will have appeared when you hear that. That's our new podcast that we're doing. We're reading all the published works of Stephen King in publication order. First episode's on Carrie. You can go to rangetouch.com in order to learn about that. Or you can go to patreon.com/rangetouch in order to learn about it and support us. If you don't support us, think about doing so. You can do it for as little as $1 a month. That helps fund this show. It helps fund the other podcasts and YouTube shows that we do. It's the cheapest media you're going to buy. It's cheaper than a cup of coffee. Mm-hmm. Cheaper than renting Hobbs and Shaw on Amazon.com, which you shouldn't be doing anyway.
Because of the movie or because it's Amazon?
Both.
Okay.
Boom.
Until
take that,
next.
Take that, The Rock. We're coming for you.
This is the next turn that this show takes, is just us having an ongoing feud with The Rock.
Mm-hmm. Take that, San Andreas. More like, San sucks. Get out of here, The Rock. The Tooth Fairy.
Until next time, war never changes, but Fallout sure has.